Okay, good morning.
Good morning.
And you look all refreshed. You apparently didn't spend that much time considering. Or it was a very easy decision, one of the two here. So let's, before we get rolling here, if you would, just we'll start with a couple quiet minutes, a little meditation here on unity, if you will. Gentle God, please show me the things that I already know, but am unaware of. Reveal to me the wisdom that I already have. I have failed to pay attention to my life and squandered the riches of my own experience. I'm like Gulliver, tethered and bound by countless old ideas. I am now ready for you to remove the blinders from my eyes. How has self-reliance failed me? Haven't even my best intentions failed to produce lasting happiness? God, please redirect that marvelous will you gave me so that it might align with yours. God, please channel my energy that my efforts might be useful to you and my fellows. If I'm to be truly happy, joyous, and free, I must be guided by the principle of unity. My heart's unspoken desire has always been to live in unity with you and my fellows. I'm now willing for you to remove the shroud of fear from my soul that I may stand in the sunlight. My fear has failed to protect me. I must let it go. Envy has blinded me to my own gifts. I must let it go. Jealousy has poisoned my loving spirit. I must let it go. I'm malnourished, for I've been feeding on my ego, starving at the banquet of love. I have lived in the insanity of separation from you and my fellows. Now is the time to turn my prodigal spirit towards home. Loving Spirit, restore me to sanity. Loving Spirit, bring my wandering spirit into unity with you and my fellows. Amen. So one of the ways that I know that I've had a spiritual awakening is that my ego doesn't like it. I was talking with Leslie before we got started here, and I was telling her, discussing whether we wanted to offer the opportunity for those that want to either, if you haven't done a third step, we could do a third step, or if, for those of you that want to renew your wedding vows, as it were, here we can participate here. And I was doing one of the, I was a young cub, and I was, it was 1999, and I was at Clint Hodges' group, this retreat center in Malibu, beautiful place, and everything else. And I arrive here, and I don't know, of course, you heard me talk about California, so I don't know any of these people. And all of a sudden, I find out I'm just about the newest pup in the room. You know, all these guys have got 30 years, 40 years, whatever's in front of me. And then we've got Clint, who's, you know, the godfather of this thing. And I make the mistake, said something about doing a third step. And he goes, "Yo, one time," or "it doesn't mean anything." I go, you know, I've been nailed to the cross right in front of the entire group. And I felt horrible, you know, so I just kind of went on. And then we took a break, and we were walking on the beach, and Clint came up and bought me an ice cream cone, and we started talking. He was very generous and said, you know, "I'm really sorry I butted in and said that the way I did." And we talked for a minute, and all of a sudden we realized we were at the same place. We were just using different language around it. And a great friendship formed there that lasted to the end of Clint's life, and he was became a great teacher for me. Here's the deal, the way I see it. You know, I do the third step. I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the God, will of God. Now, I don't really take that back, because taking that back would be implying that I return the benefits that I've received from that, and I never give any benefits back. You know, I may throw them away, but I don't give them back. What I do, the vision I have for it, is what I am is I'm a spiritual deadbeat. I'll sign for the goods. I'll ask for the spiritual awakening up front, but I don't want to pay the price when the time comes to pay the price. And I come up with an excuse or a reason or some kind of upset. And I don't know about you, but that shifts it for me, because when I start understanding, you know, I just, deadbeat doesn't feel good to me. And when I can see my behavior in that light, it helps me show up in a different way. Because, you know, there are times I didn't want to make the payment on some of those cars I bought, but I did, because I didn't want to ruin my credit rating, because I had one again, and all of that stuff. So, just a thought there. So, what do we want to do here? Do we would we like to say the third step prayer together? It's entirely a matter of your group conscience as to whether you want to do that or not.
Sure.
Okay. Well, let's do that then. You want to lead it?
Absolutely. And if you need to, I'll give you a minute to find it on page. I should know this.
Think
76. Huh? No.
63.
Right.
Just kidding. 63.
If you want to consult the book, or if you know it by heart, we all ready? Okay. God,
I offer myself to Thee.
to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I love and hope of your power, thy love, and thy life. May I do thy will.
Thank you. That was a great idea. Did you want to say something else or continue on?
Well, I think you know part of making the payments here is we're going to start dealing with some inventory, and we have three different basic inventories, as I'm sure you know. We've got the resentment inventory, we've got the fear inventory, and then we've got the sex/conduct inventory. And we're going to probably spend most of the next two sessions going through these in some level of detail, not in so much in whiteboard fashion, because what I find is that there are plenty of you among you that know how to write inventory very well. This will be more about what the benefits are and what's it sound like, feel like, and taste like. We'll both share some examples with you. And speaking for myself, Leslie's, I'm sure, is impeccable, but I want to tell you that I enjoy the life I do today because of the willingness to write some really bad inventory over the years. From stuff, if a sponsee brought it to me today, you know, I'd go, really? You know? So it wasn't technically correct necessarily, but it just transformed my life. See, the main thing, the most dangerous decision I can make here is that Don told me. He says, you know, you can do pretty much, you can make all kinds of mistakes as long as you don't take the position that I'm only doing this one time. And if you do decide you're only doing it one time, then it better be perfect. But if you're willing to do it the way you did drugs on an as-needed basis, then you know, relax and let it go. So if your sponsor or some wise person that you know tells you to do it some way different, I don't have any argument with that at all. Just by all means, they're right and I'm wrong. So I think Leslie was going to step in and talk about resentments with us a little bit.
Gosh, I sure don't write impeccable inventory. I really good with kind of getting all my stuff out and then I need help. I need someone else to, you know, I'm looking at it like this, and I need somebody to say, why don't you move over here and look at it from this side? And it's like, oh, I didn't realize that. You know, I think, I guess before I launch into some inventory is what I've discovered at the end of a long process usually is that I forget who I am. You know, that's really fundamentally the problem, is that I don't know, I don't remember. I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been my buddy Meister Eckhart uses the term Gelassenheit. Gelassenheit, talking about God, God's nature, that God is lazy, Gelassenheit, that God is just giving herself away, just bodying forth creation in this infinite love, just giving himself away as this infinite love. And that's who I am, you know, created, some people say in the image and likeness of God, but I am the creation of this force of the universe. And I, you know, and my sorrow is that I don't know that. I have this image often of a mirror, you know, I look in the mirror and there's me and then there's the image of me. And I often confuse, you know, my consciousness thinks that it's real. In a sense, that it's the real me. And so it's just merely an image, you know, without me it is nothing. When I move away, there's nothing there. And it's the same thing with my relationship with God, that without God, I am nothing. You know, now the image in the mirror is real, but it's real as an image. And I take all my chips and I put it on that. And I forget that everything I could ever possibly want is freely given to me. Just for my asking, you know, in this third step, just here, take everything and show me. My most powerful prayers are just those two words, show me, help me, enlighten me, use me, teach me. And so there's, you know, an interesting thing happened this morning. I just don't ask God why anymore. But I was walking this morning, the sun wasn't even up, and I was just taking a little, I thought I'd just walk the grounds a little bit before going to Mass at 7 o'clock. And so I'm walking, it's still dark, and I don't know where I'm going, I can't really see, and so I just start walking toward the sanctuary, and then I just keep walking around, and I go out sort of toward the road, and it says that there's a little path, it's a concrete sidewalk. I think it said prayer path, walk of prayer, something like that. And so I just keep going, and it's dark, and some cars are coming, people for Mass, and I finally find a place where I can sit down. It's this little concrete outcropping there where people have names of people who have donated money, I think. And I sit there, and I'm just meditating, just sitting there meditating, and I don't know why it comes to me. I was thinking of this old Catholic nun. She was a Cistercian too. Like these guys are Cistercian, Trappist Cistercians, and Mechtilde of Medburg, and she's one of these, you know, old Catholic mystics that I'm so fond of, and this old nun, and I don't know. It just comes to me this story I remember reading, that she said that God had put on her heart, or God spoke to her essentially, and said, revealed to her that he voluntarily, willingly made himself lovesick for her, such that he didn't know if he could go on being God without her. And she says, well, then if you have willingly made yourself so smitten with me that you don't know if you can endure being God without me, she says, I'll make you an offer. She says, come home with me, and I'll be your physician forever. And I love that. And in the German, it's, you know, it's lovesick and physician, and it's this wonderful, this radical love that waits for the reciprocation of this radical love, you know, that God just wants me to be together, you know. And so I think about this, I guess I said all that to say this, that I am so connected to God. God is my next breath. I mean, everything. I am nothing without this higher power. And I have this essence. When I reach out for it, it's already there for me. When I ask for help, it's already there for me. And so I forget that all this stuff that I added on to me, you know, all the armor and all the tanks and the artillery that I use to walk through life, in this process of coming closer to God, is this process of discarding all that. I don't need it. You know, all my protection comes from God. I can just take it all off, and I think, oh, if I do that, I'm going to get shot and killed. And it's like, well, you know, I finally got to the place where I was already dead, so it didn't matter if I got shot at, right? So just drop it all. Just drop it all. And like Mike says, you know, sometimes I pick it back up, like, oh, my God, I need my shield. And it's just, you know, just keep dropping it all. And so what do I see when I do that? You know, what do I see that separates me? And I think that's the function of this inventory. So, you know, it starts in the book. It talks about this, about resentment inventory, right? It's killed. It's deadly. And I love in that paragraph, that the one paragraph where it uses fatal and deadly and all this kind of stuff. It's beautifully written, you know. So I'll share. I think what I'll do is I'll just share some inventory is written. And I love writing stuff. It's so powerful to write things down. You know, it's like a signed confession in your own handwriting. When I was doing the steps from the wall, you know, the off-the-wall steps, as somebody pointed out to me, and I'm sitting there like, oh, yeah, yeah, I got this and this. It's another thing. When it's rattling around in your head, it can morph into something completely different. But when it's written down, and I remember the first one, the first resentment inventory I did, and I had a politician down, and he had been sleeping with somebody, and I was just indignant, you know, and didn't even know the guy, and I'm writing it down, and, you know, and I said, you know, it was Bill Clinton, and it was a long time ago, and so and it has nothing to do with my politics or anything, it was just like, he just happened to be in the way, and so it's Bill Clinton, right, and he's, and what's the cause? Well, he's getting away with something I would have lost my job over. It was my battle cry, and it was all about, well, you know, he's sleeping around, and it's the sex and the lying and all this kind of stuff, and what does it affect? And now this is, you know, early inventory, so it's like it gets sketchy. I'm pretty clear who I'm mad at and why, but what it affects my self-esteem, I don't know. What does it affect my faith in government? I guess I don't know, something like that. And so then we get to the my mistakes column, right? And I got nothing, you know. It's like, hey, I don't even know the guy, you know. It's not. I was minding my own business, and so there's nothing there. And she and it was so powerful because she turned it around and she, you know, she's sitting there. She turned around. And she said, well, and she's looking at it. She said, well, she said, do you think it could be that your mistake is jealousy? And I'm thinking, I'm not jealous of Bill Clinton. What do you mean? No, it's about honor and dignity and respect. You know, like I know something about this, right? And she said, well, let's look at what you wrote. What you wrote is he's getting away with something. She said, that's jealousy. And I remember looking at that and looking at that and looking at that, and it's like, Oh, and it was so, I mean, you know, when you look at this stuff, it's just so petty. It's often so petty. And I looked at it, I thought, oh my God, I'm somebody like that. I said, I didn't know that. And she said, I know, honey, that's why we're doing it. It's okay. We're going to bring this stuff to the surface, and then I'll show you what to do with it. So this is a much better inventory. This was actually written when I had that bartending job I told you about, and so I'm working in this fine dining restaurant after the market crashes. And, of course, shortly after that, the fine dining restaurant is going downhill, too, because nobody's spending all this money on steaks and fine wine and all this kind of stuff. And so the owner hires a guy who works for the Pacers. And he's when you ask this guy what he did, he tell you he was a babysitter for these, you know, rich basketball players. And I guess he just kind of shuffled them around and make sure they don't talk to bad people and do right things and join charities and all this kind of stuff. And so, but Chris had he had more connections than an Erector set. I mean, he was a young guy. He knew everybody, right? And so Dunaway hired him to drive business in, to bring his people in. But his people were late night people, right? And I'm working in this, you know, we just come in. I come in at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, set up the bar, have a nice little dinner. People are respectable. They go home at a decent hour. It's all shut up and buttoned up by 11 o'clock, right? And I get to go home, make my big money, and go home. This guy wants to keep the bar up until 3 a.m. He wants to come in like, yeah, we'll have the dinner crowd. Now we're going to have some appetizers. We're going to have a DJ. And I'm like, oh, no, I'm not in for that at all. So I'll just read this. So I'm resentful at Chris, the cause. He's arrogant, smug, misogynistic, thinks he knows how the world really is, right? Thinks the world revolves around sports and the rich and famous. His heroes are punks. Now, I wrote this like 10 years ago. His heroes are punks. So I'm allegedly sober, right? I mean, I haven't had a drink in 13 years, 14 years. As Rich and Finn is, he wants to turn the bar into a bar. He's encouraging a late night crowd. He doesn't take an interest in me in a polite society way. So, you know, you'd say, like when he comes in, hey, Chris, how you doing? He says, fine. And he's like, you're supposed to ask me how I am. That's how this goes. You know, that's what my grandmother taught me. And you just walk on. Thinks he has a successful life, and I think it's shallow. So what does this affect? My self-esteem. I'm not respected. I'm the help, right? I'm not an ally or an equal. Financial security. I think he'd like to see me go. He is actually increasing my financial security.
Emotional security. I get agitated and impatient with him, and it disturbs my serenity. I become negative and, well, I won't say that word. I don't like the way it makes me feel, and I don't like the way it looks, you know, because I'm still in the image management business. I don't want to look like that girl that's really a jerk, like, yeah, I'm rolling my eyes. I don't want to look that. I don't want to be that way, and I don't want to look that way. Ambition. What I want is to not work like, and he's destroying that. Oh my God. destroying. I like the, it's just my burden. I like the money, but I don't want to have to work for it, right? Personal relationships. I get short with staff and guests. I become a doomsayer, you know, not a problem solver. Oh, this is not going to work. I feel I always have to guard my interests, right? So what are my mistakes here? I act like the help, right? You know, he treats me like the help because I act like the help. I want to punch in and punch out. Don't ask me to do anything else. It ain't my job, right? I don't do that. I'd want to see me go too. He was hired to drive in business, and that's what he's doing. I'm not cooperative. I'm sure it's not personal. He just needs a late night bartender. I feel that I forget I'm an employee and what that means. I forget my security comes from God. You know, cut and paste. I can put that on everyone. I forget my security comes from God, and I have to defend myself. I forget to live in the moment and do the next right thing. You know, the next thing is take the glasses and put them in the dishwasher. You know, I don't need to tell him how this ain't going to work. I have a very hard time with authority. Oh, I do. I just chafe at the saddle, you know. I think I'm smarter than most people. I want many things without the discomfort of working for them. And I call that slendy. It's a combination of sloth and envy. You know, I want what you have, but I really don't want to have to work that hard to get it. I want to do the bare minimum. I feed and perpetuate negative attitudes. I'm selfish with my time and my interests. I'm so selfish with my time. I'm busy doing stuff. You know, I've been to a meeting today. I got to go pick you up and take you to a meeting. I mean, Law and Order is going to come on in 20 minutes, and I've already been to a meeting. Now, I end up doing the right thing, but I'll tell you what, that thought will come through my head, like, gosh, you know, why can't these girls ride the bus, you know? So, I do have a fear inventory there. So that's what, you know, what do I do with that? What do I do with that? And it starts with just illuminating this. What are my mistakes? It's not my part. It's not like, you know, hey, I've got 60% of this, but you got 40, you know. So you work on some stuff, I'll work on some stuff. This is how am I walking through life? And this is what I don't want to do. And so I realize this is where I wake up and realize that I've gone off into the weeds and the thorns. And I want to say, oh gosh, I want to be, God, I want to be on the broad highway walking hand in hand in the, you know, in the sunlight of the Spirit with you. And just coming back, like in meditation, the dog's bark. Oh no, come back. Here we are. So, you know, this bell of mindfulness is the function of doing this 4-step and allowing, getting me to a place where I can clean out all the science projects in the refrigerator, you know, just get it all clean so that God can come in, you know, the real me can be revealed. So I'll just stop there.
Okay. Wow, I'm envious already. Your handwriting is so neat. And you can see what mine looks like here. Well, here's a piece of resentment inventory. It wasn't the first inventory, but I like it because it's still echoing in my life to this day. I wrote this inventory about 26 and a half, 27 years ago, and what had happened is I managed to blow up that sober marriage. And I was really bereft at that time. And so I get, I mean, I, I'm what was it? I took my, I think my 7-year token. I'm living in a sleeping bag that I've got on the floor of my friend's den. He lets me put my sleeping bag in there, and I'm just so full of self-pity. You know, look what God has done to me, and all of this stuff. But what I didn't see at the time is I was no good at being a 7-day-a-week dad to that stepson of mine. It turns out I was a really good 3- or 4-night-a-week dad. I didn't see the gift right then. So Andrew's a very interesting kid. I'm bringing him home from daycare when we were still married, this was kind of new one. And he's maybe 4 years old, and the 4-year-old turns to me and he says, "You know, Mike," he says, "I think things might go better for you if you start saying the second thing that comes to your mind."
Would you be my sponsor?
Yeah. And I tell you this to give you a feel who we're dealing with here. I kept saying, "Lori," I said, "you know, I don't know anything about being a dad. How do I do this? How do I do this?" She says, "You know, if you pay attention to him, he'll show you." Huh? What a crazy idea! Pay attention to the kid, you know. And again, we're having one of those drives not too far long after I said that, and he turns to me and he says, "You know, Mike," he says, "I've got lots of friends." He says, "I need you to be my dad."
Oh, God.
And he just told me to essentially knock off the buddy-buddy bullshit and show up as an adult in my life. You know? So this is the case. We get here, okay, the marriage has exploded. I do my time in the sleeping bag. I've now got my own apartment again. And Andrew and I are going to have a weekend together. And he says, "Look, Mike," he says, "I want to go to a real restaurant tonight." He says, "I don't want no McDonald's playground, no Applebee's, none of that stuff. I want to go to a real restaurant with tablecloths and china." Okay, I've learned by this time, as you wish, you know. And so we go out to dinner, and it's Friday night, and we're, as you might guess, he's pretty good company. He's about 7 by this time, and he's, you know, just we're sitting there having dinner in this restaurant, and all of a sudden I look up and I look around the restaurant, and my God, this place is full of nothing but couples in love. And I'm here with the 7-year-old. Look what God has done to me. And the self-pity tsunami just hits me. So I know how to act by this time. So we finish up dinner, go home, watch a video, and, you know, he gets his shower, put him to bed, we do a little bedtime story, and that's it. And I'm out at the kitchen table, and I'm writing inventory, because I'm pissed at God. So this is what this sounds like, and it's real untidy here. So it's right across the top, interestingly enough, not in the book, but I was just taught to write a short prayer, and so my prayer here is, I'm resenting God, of course, but I... God, please help me. You know, I don't see the disconnect there. just like always, I'm willing to borrow money from you and disdain you at the same time. So, so I resent God. I resent God because I don't have the relationship I want to have with a woman. I think that God will only give me the choice between having a sick relationship or no relationship. I'm lonely. People with less recovery, people I sponsor, are having better relationships than I am. Okay. I'm afraid that God will keep me in this pain because I'll be more useful to others than if I have.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Whew. Unfortunately, it gets worse. Yes. I feel like God has given me a gift of communicating with others, and the price of the gift is my own happiness. I'm... Woo! Well,
That's so good.
I'm mad because I know that only God can help me, and I don't believe He will.
This is so good.
Turns out that's a spiritual death sentence. That's all I need to do to put myself beyond help. Just believe that God won't or is not interested. I don't need to do anything more than that. So what's this effect? Well, it affects my self-esteem. I feel like I'd sell out my principles for a comfortable relationship. For example, I might do something like hitting on a newcomer. As a result, I feel like a phony. Don said, Mike, that's because you're a phony. Yeah. Whoa. Yes. Distorting my sex relations, I'm having an increasingly emotionally unsatisfying sex-only relationship. Now, this was the early 90s, and outsourcing was a big deal, so I decided to outsource my sex life. And... Well, I mean, I'm a spiritual giant. I don't want to cause harms in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So what I do is I find this gal who's wasn't a part of any 12-step program, and she was kind of like-minded in this area, and we agreed no movies, no dinners, no cards, no anniversaries, no nothing. That we would just, and there were, this was pre-texting and all that days, so what we had to do to make this work was we'd call each other's secretaries and ask for appointments to play racquetball, was the code word. So here I've got all this... acrobatic life with no attachments, no responsibilities. So, and it's not working. It's not. It seemed like an answer, but it's not working. And again, thank God for Don, because Don said, Mike, thank God it's not working. He says, if you were the type of human being who could use somebody else that way and be okay with it, there would be very little hope for you. The fact that this is not working means there's hope for you. Huh, never saw that. So affecting my personal relations keeps me jealous of others, comparing myself to them, coveting what I think they have. I'm unwilling to share my pain. Anybody else been there? I feel ashamed, apart from, flawed, and different. My unbalanced drive in this area makes me vulnerable to getting drunk. Compromising my principles will get me drunk, and I know I don't have the strength not to do this. Now, I was still confused, and I wrote my part on the top of this, but I got straightened out on that, too. I got to the point, I was reading this to Don, and I said... You know, here's my part. He says, whoa, stop. I says, what? He says, well, we can't go any further. I says, why not? He says, well, you clearly haven't taken the third step. I says, what are you crazy? We did it together. And he says, well, if you're deciding what's your part and what's their part and all this, you're still playing God, so you clearly never made or didn't mean that your decision to... in the third step, and then he walked me into that part in the book that we're all familiar with over there about my mistakes. So, okay. So, I'm not willing to give this to God because I don't think He's interested or willing to help. There's the, you know, what's God care about my recreational life here, my relations? I'm willing to sell out for relief, you know. Principles out the window as long as I can feel better. I'm impatient. I'm I'm not willing to take an honest look at what this fantasy relationship won't do for me. I'm pretending if I can just get this little piece lined up, everything will be skippy here. I want somebody else to fill me up and make me feel safe and secure. So so we're at dinner about 6:30. I'm home. He's in bed by 9:30. I'm writing this. I'm calling Gary across town right away and reading it to him. See, I didn't have to join a workshop or do anything fancy here. I just reminded myself of my commitment to the first three steps, picked up the pen, got busy with the writing, called Brown. If he said something meaningful, I don't remember what it was. And so I called Don in Denver, and Don, I shared some of the comments with you there, and he also said something that I didn't think much of at the time. He said, Mike, I'd like you to start saying this prayer. And I says, oh, okay. What's prayer? I'm going to get the magic prayer. He says, oh, it's just this, God, please teach me about love. And I said, okay. And I called Clinton, L.A., because I'm sure the five-time married Clinton, L.A., would be more understanding and has some better advice for me than... And it was essentially the same. Now, part of the deal here is I had with Don was that if I took his direction and I didn't like the results, I got to complain. So 2 weeks later, I called Don up, and I says, Don, I says, you need to know I don't think much of your damn prayer. And he says, well, tell me about that, cowboy. And so I did. I says, I've been saying your prayer and everything, you know. And the one gal that I thought maybe there was a chance with, her company just transferred her out of state, and so that's off the table. And to put a cherry on top of the whole thing, I went to my doctor last week. He said my blood pressure was high. He gave me some medication, and it's made me impotent. And he laughs, and he says, you misunderstood that prayer, didn't you? He said, you thought that prayer was God get me a woman, didn't you? And he says, Mike, he says, you're a man that knows a great deal about sex and knows nothing about love. And here's the main thing. One of the reasons he and some of these other people that have been such effective teachers with me, we don't, I think, talk about it as much as we should. The secret ingredient to all this was that I knew he loved me. That's why I was willing to listen. That's why I was willing to go in a direction I didn't feel like. And he would consciously remind me that. He would touch me, and I didn't like being touched at the time, you know. And I thought, why do you do that? He says, because when I'm touching you, it's impossible for you to shut me out and deny my presence in your life. You know, the fact I love you. That's what, and he learned how to touch in prison, where it was sometimes kind of dangerous if you didn't touch the right way, and kind of that's what the best of us that I encounter are, we're really healers, you know. And it begins with that touch or the hug, and so forth, and because somehow we sense that there's love here, we're willing to do some things we hadn't been willing to pay attention to before. And he says, Mike, I love you. Please trust me. Keep saying the prayers. So I did. And he said, you know, tell me about this fantasy woman that you think is going to make everything right. So I did. I told him in detail exactly who and what she was and how she was and all this kind of stuff. And he says, well, He says, that's quite a list. He says, now on the off chance such a woman actually exists, why would she want to have anything to do with you? And he said, do you really think God is going to mess with some nice girl's life to make yours better? He says, if you want that woman in your life, you have to become somebody that woman would be interested with. And he said, weren't you always afraid? Again, we talked about it last night. Weren't you always afraid that God would shaft you in order to give somebody else something? So why would God, if you essentially end up with who you deserve at the end of the day? And so I went on, and I started saying the prayer, and or kept saying the prayer, and the first thing I noticed is that I fell wildly head over heels in love with that 7-year-old kid in a way that I'd always liked him. But I loved him. I loved him like a rainbow. And I was an old Vietnam guy. Still Vietnam guy. I did not have a kind opinion of my brothers that had taken the option of heading off to Canada instead of heading off to war. And my reasoning behind that, for what it was worth, and it wasn't worth much, was that it wasn't that somebody went, it's that somebody else took their place. And I helped bury those guys. But this was at the time of the first Gulf War, and I remember I'm following Andrew up the sidewalk into that apartment of mine, and I'm looking at that kid's back. And I remember, because it was such a foreign thought to me, if they want to take him for the service, I'll drive him to Canada myself. And see, that was completely off the radar. I mean, I just had never loved anybody like that. And I don't know if I explained it well, but it was kind of an earth-shifting moment for me. And so I kept saying the prayer, and the next thing you know, I fell in love with my ex-wife, and I didn't want to marry her again, but the best I can describe it is God restored her to the place she had in my heart before we got married and started banging into each other. And one of the first things we were able to do together after the divorce is we went to a PTA meeting, and I was dropping Lori off at the house afterward, and she's in the program too, and so we, you know, amends had been made and all that kind of stuff. And what we come down to was that we were two people that were really well suited to being each other's good friend. But we were alcoholics, so being married seemed like it'd be more. And so we did that, and all that had happened is God put things back to work. And she's a good friend to this day. Happily congratulated me on my marriage and all. Been a cheerleader throughout my recovery. But I'm dropping her off after this PTA meeting, and I turned to her and I said, Lori, you know, I think about the only bad feeling I've got left about the divorce is that it interrupted our friendship. And I looked over there, and she's got that grin on her face ear to ear, and she's, you still don't get it, do you, Mike? I says, okay, what? She says, Mike, it was the marriage that interrupted our friendship, not the divorce. Oh. Yeah. And so I'm saying the prayer, and I'm saying the prayer and saying the prayer, and eventually she did show up, and Linda, you know, and She was way too pretty, way too young, way too smart, everything. And we'd been AA pals for a long time. Well, it's a wonderful thing, and her husband was a good friend of mine, and we did a lot of stuff, all of us together, and then a terrible thing happened, and her husband got a diagnosis on Labor Day, or just before Labor Day, of pancreatic cancer, and he died in the first week of November of that year. It was terrible. And so we kept doing things, and eventually she and I we went out and spoke together and did any number of things. We did a local workshop one Saturday, and we're in the parking lot after the workshop, and she kind of followed me over to my car, and she said, "Mike, there's something I got to tell you." And, "Well, what?" And she says, "Well, Mike, I love you." And I said, "Well, that's nice." She said, "No, focus." I'm clueless. You know, she says, "I really love you. Now, I'd really like a hug and not one of those AA air hugs you've been giving me." And it started. And Leslie knew her. And it was a wonderful thing. And we had great, we got to go all over the country, do stuff together. She was fabulous. They had her in Norway and Canada and all over the map. And we're getting ready to get married, and we're going to honeymoon in Hawaii, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I went out to Santa Fe to do a little stuff out there. And I'll be darned, one of her rules for our relationship was she was not going to be my shack-em-up honey. She says, "I've looked at your track record. If we're going to be under the same roof, we're going to be married." And so she's living over on the west side, near our airport. And so I often would go over and drop my car, put it in one of the slots in the garage, and she'd drive me to the airport so we could save parking for people when we were doing things. So anyway, I almost didn't do it this time because I had such an early flight that when she said, "Please, I'd like to take you." So I went over there, and she came out in her little pink jammies and all that kind of stuff, got in the car and drove me to the airport and gave her a kiss and said goodbye and went off to Santa Fe. And I'm coming back a few days later, and I'm calling, and I'm not getting her. Now, at that time, she's deputy director of the Indiana Department of Revenue, so she had a job. She was moving jobs within there. She was going from some motor traffic division to individual and corporate business returns division, and so I thought, well, maybe I just missed her between the offices or something. And I land in Indy and still know Linda, so I take a cab over her house. I do have a key, so I let myself in, and I found her on the floor of the bathroom. She was 48 years old, and didn't know it until later. She was conscious and blinking her eyes, but couldn't talk. And she'd had a massive stroke is what had happened. And so go from Mary's Hawaii to riding in the ambulance to neurointensive care at the hospital. And it looks like things are getting better. And we've been there a few days, and I go out for lunch, and her sister calls me in a panic and says, "Mike, you got to get back here. They just told us we got to go to hospice." Hospice? You know, what's that? Well, they did another, she'd had another bleed. And so here I am in hospice with the gal that I planned to marry in a few months. And because of what you taught me and Don had taught me, he says, Mike, as near as I can tell, there will always be at least two of you present in every situation. There's the good guy, the decent guy who wants to do the right thing, and a little selfish shit over here that it's all about him. He says, you can't do anything about that. He says, if you... It's kind of like having a wet drunk in the meeting, you know, when that selfish piece, he says, if you try and shut them up, they just get louder. So you put them in a corner and let them do whatever they're going to do. He says, but you don't have them chair the meeting. And so I'm sitting there the last night of her life with her in hospice, and... it looks like all my dreams have gone down the toilet here. And it's all self-centered. And I can say thank you for sharing and stay with her and be present with her and get the awakening. What would be more self-centered than making the last hours of her life all about me and how I feel about it? So she passed, and then the next incredible thing happened that her family came to me and said, because I'd done a funeral service for her dad some years before, they said, Mike, we'd like to have you do the service for Linda. I didn't know if I could be at the service, let alone do the service. But God shows up, and I'm thinking, wow, this prayer, some prayer, God teach me about love. Yeah, I open myself up. I really, really give myself in love, and look what happens. But I persisted in the prayer because I knew I was loved here. And... So we did that, and it turns out that the next lesson from that prayer was that I needed to learn how to receive love, because a lot of people in our community love both of us, certainly her and some of them me, and those people wanted to love us. And you'd think that would be easy, but it turned out I realized letting people love me was a very frightening experience. See, when I'm loving you, I decide what it's going to look like, how much there's going to be, and, you know, all that. It's all up to me. And when I'm receiving love from you, you're in charge of all those things. And so what if I'm really leaning into you loving me, and you go, well, that's about enough, Mike. I think it's time to move on. And, you know, I'm there. I learned how to trust. And I persisted. And then the next lesson, I got the wonderful gift. I call them, because I'd had the love experience, I'd have had the top of the mountain experience with Linda and everything else, that I was in a different place, and I all of a sudden it accumulated without realizing or intending to, what I call came to call my friends without benefits. All these wonderful women that were in my life, and they were there as friends, and I got to have and still do have some really, really wonderful relationships with them. And it turns out that the chickens act different when there's no fox in the hen house, you know. And I'm sorry, guys, but women make better friends than you do for the most part. Don used to have a saying. He says, well, if it's got a motor attached to it, ask a guy about it. But if it's got any kind of a feeling attached to it, you want to talk to a woman. And, you know, I love the intuitiveness. I, you know, my gal friends have explained powerlessness to me in a way that I could never have gotten on my own. And so that was that piece. And then 4 years ago, I just came back from a long trip out to California, if you can believe it. And I'd agreed to do this little one-day conference in Flyspeck, Indiana, that I really didn't want. And so I went and did it anyway, and I met a gal there. She drove her Al-Anon sponsor to this thing, and because her sponsor's husband was going through chemo and had a bunch of stuff going on, and the sponsor was... Anyway, long story short, I meet Jess there, and Jess didn't even stay for the talk. She listened to a CD of it later that her sponsor got, and then she started corresponding with me via email. She lived in Louisville, Kentucky, and I live about 2 hours up the road in Indianapolis, but I get down to Louisville for time to time. So I one day I'm in Louisville and on a weekend, and we went to her home group, went out to lunch, and now we're going to take a walk on the big footbridge over the Ohio River there. And as we're getting ready, I've had a good time. She's cute. She's, again, all the stuff. And she stops me as we're getting ready to go out on the bridge. I got to tell you, Jess is 5'2". So now Al-Anon has got their flaws. By the way, she lied on her first driver's license and told the people at the license bureau she was 5'3". And I pointed that out to her, and she got honest on the next license. But we're getting ready to walk over. She stops me, turns me around, takes my hands, and she says, "Mike, you seem confused, so I'm going to straighten out a few things here. I've got a brother, I've got an uncle, and I've got a daddy, and I don't need you to do any of those jobs. And by the way, this is a date, and you don't seem to realize it." And she got up on her toes and gave me a kiss. That was May 31st, 2014. June 30th of this year, we got married. And it's been the greatest gift ever, and we'll probably talk about that some more. But the point is, I go to this dinner. It turns out badly. I'm full of self-pity. I'm mad at God. I write the inventory. As a result of the inventory, I'm saying the prayer. As a result of saying the prayer, I get carried through innumerable situations in life up to this day. And the prayer still seems to be working. And now Jess and I will hold hands and say it together. So this is a good time to take a break. We'll take whatever break your conscience dictates and be back here in about 15 minutes. Yeah.